Thanks for listening to Chicago's Morning Answer podcast, sponsored by Signature Bank. Signature Bank takes pride in helping customers grow their business and provide unmatched banking expertise, custom financial solutions, and the industry's best technology. So whether you're a business looking for a deposit relationship or needs a ready source of financing, Signature Bank is the right bank for you. Call today at 773-467-5600 to hear how Signature Bank can help your business grow and thrive. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.
This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Good morning, Dan and Amy. So Brett Kavanaugh, a good pick or Trump selling out with a insider elitist beltway selection? 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line. 646-36-DA, turnkey.pro text line. Here's the president announcing his pick last night.
In keeping with President Reagan's legacy, I do not ask about a nominee's personal opinions. What matters is not a judge's political views, but whether they can set aside those views to do what the law and the Constitution require. I am pleased to say that I have found, without doubt, such a person. Tonight, it is my honor and privilege to announce that I will nominate Judge Brett Kavanaugh to the United States Supreme Court.
And the people seem to like this.
They did. I was, I was pleasantly surprised because, of course, I was pulling for the lady. I was pulling for Amy Coney Barrett. But guess what happened? She never left her house in South Bend, Indiana yesterday. So by 4 o'clock, I conceded and realized it was Brett Kavanaugh. He seems law-abiding, respects the Constitution. Of course, he has great credentials, went to Yale. His mother is a prosecutor. His dad's an attorney as well. But you know what I like best, Dan? Not to go off the rails here.
He's a girls' basketball coach.
Not only that, a winning girls' basketball coach.
The girls on the team call me Coach K. I am proud of our Blessed Sacrament team that just won the city championship.
People respect that. They respect the game of basketball. And hopefully he'll continue coaching his daughters, Margaret and Lisa.
Maybe he could take over for Blaine. Didn't bring it home.
Hey, watch yourself.
It's a split decision at Blaine.
No, volleyball, we brought it home, not basketball.
Yeah. It was very interesting. One of the things, before we get into his judicial background, just his acceptance speech for the nomination, if you will. You know, he was at the Bush White House, which is where he met his wife. He's been inside the Beltway his entire life, his entire professional career. And he's very politically savvy, and there's nothing wrong with that. But it was very, and maybe this is who this guy is, I don't know. But it was very Brett Kavanaugh, not from inside the Beltway, but from Mayberry.
Yeah.
Speaking
of his wife, his mother, his parents were there in the front row. It was very touching. They were teary-eyed and, you know, of course, so proud of their son.
One of the few women prosecutors of that time, she overcame barriers and became a trial judge. The president introduced me tonight as Judge Kavanaugh. But to me, that title will always belong to my mom. My dad went to law school at night while working full time. He has an unparalleled work ethic and has passed down to me his passion for playing and watching sports. I love him dearly. The motto of my Jesuit high school was men for others. I've tried to live that creed. I've spent my career in public service from the executive branch and the White House to the U.S. Court of Appeals for the D.C. Circuit. I've served with 17 other judges, each of them a colleague and a friend. My judicial philosophy is straightforward. A judge must be independent and must interpret the law, not make the law. A judge must interpret statutes as written, and a judge must interpret the Constitution as written.
So, he presented a great case. He's clearly likable, and in giving of his time. He's philanthropic, you know, works for Catholic Charities, delivers meals to the homeless, and respects women. He made a point to say a majority of his law clerks that he has hired are women.
Yeah, well, that's the whole point, is the political savvy nature of his introduction and to start crafting the narrative around him, because he knows that the onslaught was starting even before he finished his speech. The organizers of the Women's March sending out a press release with name, insert name right here, before the nomination was even made public. So he understands what he's up against. And so you had the full complement of personal story, his professional career, his family, meets his wife at the Bush White House. She is the town manager in the community in which they live. The two daughters he goes through, the coaching that he does, his education, his mom. And even before his mom as a trailblazer when it came to the legal profession, it was his mom as a history teacher in predominantly African-American high schools in D.C.
I was lucky. My mom was a teacher. In the 1960s and 70s, she taught history at two largely African-American public high schools in Washington, D.C., McKinley Tech and H.D. Woodson. Her example taught me the importance of equality for all Americans.
So
it was we're not a racist family.
It was a three-dimensional presentation of Brett Kavanaugh. I'm not just a judge, and I'm not just somebody that has this particular originalist textualist philosophy when it comes to the Constitution, when it comes to a judge's responsibility to the Constitution, anti-equal justice for law. There's also all of this that forms me as well. And so it's important because his audience is not those people in the room. His audience is the United States Senate. His audience is the American public and popular opinion as this confirmation battle, and it will be a battle, goes forward. Bill in Crown Point, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Good morning, guys. I just want to kind of chime in on this choice factor here. You know, the bias application with the Democrats just going into complete hysteria is just absolute nonsense. If I can recall correctly, Barack Obama loaded the Supreme Court with Sotomayor and Kagan. Sotomayor was indeed, maybe correct me, Dan, if I'm wrong, was his law professor.
No.
So the agenda factors.
No.
Or was it Kagan?
Yeah, Kagan, who he mentioned in his remarks, hired him to teach at Harvard. So there's another little, you know, jab to the left as well by, you know, Elena Kagan, when she was dean at Harvard, she didn't think I was some right-wing lunatic. She thought enough of me to hire me to teach at Harvard, to teach law students at Harvard. So that says something as well.
All right. Very well. Have a great day, guys.
Thanks for the call, Bill. Yeah, he's got a lot there, which is why some of the immediate reactions from, you know, that if you could just push out the white noise for a minute, you know, Chuck Todd calling him very confirmable, Susan Collins saying he has impressive credentials. So it's going to be a battle, and there'll be some ugliness. But
well, how many red state Democrats do you think will vote for him?
Well, I think that's going to be part of the. But part of how we see this process move forward. So
yeah,
we'll
Pence
see how
is taking him door to door today to meet senators.
But the behind the door stuff is fine, and they're going to have refer to pleasant conversations when they get before the cameras and do the actual confirmation hearing. The real test will be how he stands up to public scrutiny during the public confirmation hearing. And I think part of this selection with ultimately a group of finalists, if you will, that were all very qualified and talented and so forth, is that this is a guy who knows this arena and will withstand the pressure and present well in this arena.
Oh, he knows how the game is played.
And make the confirmation. And he has the skill set, the political savvy to work his way through a confirmation hearing and make it that much easier for the president. So I have a sense that was a bit of a deciding factor here.
It's what Chicago is talking about. It's Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan and Amy on AM 560, The Answer.
Dan and Amy talking about Trump's SCOTUS pick, Brett Kavanaugh, and already the protests are planned. The group Refuse Fascism, the fascist group Refuse Fascism, planning protests in 12 American cities, including our beloved Chicago. Chicago chapter event is entitled Keep Abortion Legal, No Fascist Supreme Court. That's going to be the rallying cry of the left as it comes to Kavanaugh.
Just don't shut down the Dan Ryan. Is that all right? One person real quickly who's happy that Thomas Hardiman didn't get it. Hardiman was the alleged runner-up to Neil Gorsuch. Another Thomas P. Hardiman, this guy, director of student conduct at North Carolina State University. He
also not selected.
Also not selected, but he wanted to remind the Twitter world because he was getting thousands of followers and all this, hey, good luck today, and then reasons why people are pulling for him. Hey, a friendly announcement to the Twitter world. I am not the Thomas Hardiman who may be nominated Supreme Court.
He could have been.
I want to get that message out to the public, and mentions have already started to begin. And then later on, he tweeted out, please don't let it be me, hashtag SCOTUS pick.
Yeah, he's not ready for it. And he likes North Carolina State. Sure, the Wolfpack.
Yeah.
Rick Santorum rallied. He was an advocate for Thomas Hardiman. I don't know if it was the NC State guy or the actual appellate court judge. I think it was the appellate court judge from Pennsylvania. But Santorum, he was disappointed with the selection. Here's Santorum on CNN yesterday.
Donald Trump said he was going to energize the base with this pick. I don't think he did that. I think a lot of the folks in the base were sort of turned off to Brett Kavanaugh for the very reasons you heard discussed a few minutes ago. I mean, he is from Washington. He is the establishment pick. He is the Bush pick. He is someone. I mean, just, you know, his father was a judge. His mother was a judge. It just seems like, you know, Trump in this case just bowed to the elite in Washington. And I think that's going to rub a lot of people the wrong way. I don't think it's going to be a game changer, but I think it's not a let's go get him kind of moment for Trump.
Yeah, I disagree with Santorum. I mean, it's all fine and good to root for Tom Hardiman, and he would have been well qualified as well. I disagree that it's not a rallying cry. Kavanaugh is a rallying cry. He's got a 12-year record, and we'll go through his important cases after we check the headlines. But this is a serious, thoughtful, conservative intellectual. And the whole kind of he worked in the Bush administration. Can we just stop doing that? Because it's done to me all the time. You're not the person that you worked for, not necessarily. So there have been great people that came out of the Reagan administration and some terrible people, too. And you could say that with every administration. I am not my boss. I am not the company I work for. And I think Brett Kavanaugh's record suggests that he can stand on his own two feet just fine. Thank you. He's not George W. Bush. He's not George Herbert Walker Bush. He's not a member of the Bush family. He's somebody who worked in the Bush White House. Relax with that. Relax with that. Ed in Oak Brook, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Yeah, you know what, Dan and Amy, my sources are telling me three things that are against this guy. One, he puts ketchup on hot dogs.
Oh, boy.
Two, he had a parking ticket in a predominantly white neighborhood. Oh. And three, he once looked at a Playboy magazine. So he said he was reading the article, but he was looking, obviously. So anyway, those are the three things that I think they're going to come up against him. Have a nice day.
Thanks for the call. With the ketchup and the hot dog, you lost Bob Surratt's vote. There's vicious commentaries about putting ketchup on a hot dog from Bob Surratt.
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. Let freedom ring this afternoon at 2 with Sean Hannity. Right before Joe Walsh at 5 on AM 560, The Answer.
Dan and Amy, Brett Kavanaugh for the court. Donald Trump introducing his selection to replace Anthony Kennedy on the Supreme Court yesterday night in prime time.
I didn't know that he was an only child.
When people ask what it's like to be an only child, I say it depends on who your parents are. I was lucky. My mom was a teacher.
Oh, yeah, then you know the rest of the story.
And so we talked a little bit about his personal background. Let's talk about his record as an attorney and a judge. And he dates back, and this is going to rankle Democrats for sure, to the Ken Starr investigation into Bill Clinton. He worked for Ken Starr first when Ken Starr was the Solicitor General of the United States and later when Starr was independent counsel. So Kavanaugh was part of the effort to impeach, successful effort to impeach President Clinton.
Yeah, he authored, he wrote the pressing questions for Bill Clinton. And then didn't he later represent Ilhan Gonzalez, too, and tried to keep him here in the country? That's what I had read, too. But I don't have a problem with that, and hopefully nobody will have a problem with that.
An interesting op-ed in the run-up to this last week over the holiday weekend by J.D. Vance, the author of Hillbilly Elegy. We've had him on the show. Yeah. He was a Yale law student. He had Judge Kavanaugh as a professor. He writes in the Wall Street Journal, he taught a foreign policy seminar the year that I was a Yale law student. What most impressed me was his willingness to defend himself and his principles in an ideologically hostile environment. For a conservative finding my way in an institution where I was heavily outnumbered, Judge Kavanaugh's mentorship and example were invaluable. A few years later, he hired my wife as a law clerk, so I'm personally a proud Kavanaugh partisan. J.D. Vance goes on to argue that he has the necessary intellectual commitments, goes through some of his case history, which we'll go through, but that his intellectual prowess is something the high court has recognized. His opinions have been adopted by the Supreme Court justices 11 times. His record spans about every important area of law, and conservatives should be happy with the results, Vance argues. And he also makes an interesting point, which is an important one, and it's very consistent with the Federalist Society philosophy. Leonard Leo, who's been the point man for this, and the Federalist Society, who've been building this pipeline of talented conservatives, talented in the judicial arena for decades. Judge Kavanaugh could also be influential beyond the bench. Like a lot of conservative law students, I acquired my conservative constitutionalism after reading Justices Scalia and Thomas rebut their more progressive colleagues. The conservatives simply have the better arguments. And so he also just makes the point that Kavanaugh has the ability, the intellectual prowess to be influential to the next generation of law students and future jurists. So that's another value add that Kavanaugh brings to the table, which is not insignificant. On the case law itself, there's a lot of, him showing up in a lot of important conservative liberal battles, if you will. You could argue they're just rule of law battles, but that's going to be seen through a partisan lens, starting back to the Clinton impeachment. But more recently, he has been key in doing a couple of things that are highly important, should be taken notice of, judicial notice, if you will, by conservatives. One is pulling back the administrative state. He's been at the tip of the spear in undermining the so-called Chevron doctrine, which would give deference to administrative agencies in rulemaking, really unaccountable lawmaking, because these are administrative officials. This is the fourth state of government, fourth branch of government that we talk about all the time, the administrative state, which Trump, perhaps his greatest accomplishment as president so far, other than Supreme Court nominees, has been regulatory relief that he's provided, rolling back some of that administrative state. That's number one. Number two, Kavanaugh and the Heller decision and extending the Heller decision. He has been a stalwart defender of an individual's right to self-protection, of an originalist interpretation of the Second Amendment. So those are just kind of two areas among many that we should take notice of before we get into this some of the sniping that's going on within conservative circles about Kavanaugh because of his affiliation with the Bush administration.
And also, too, I mean, they say that, obviously he's a Washington insider. Chuck Schumer delayed his confirmation to the, U.S. District Appellate Court in D.C. for 3 years. And he's much hell-bent on doing that again this time. He wants to try and stop it. But everyone seems to be up in arms about a piece he wrote when he talked about presidents should be shielded from litigation while in office. And a lot of people on the left think that that's why President Trump chose him, because he once, wrote those words.
Yeah, that's a position that's also held by confirmed left Democrat Alan Dershowitz. This is a legal opinion. And so, again, originalist interpretation of the Constitution, as Kavanaugh described his judicial philosophy and said to, gave his message to the Senate yesterday, which he'll be giving individually in meetings today.
I will tell each senator that I revere the Constitution. I believe that an independent judiciary is the crown jewel of our constitutional republic. If confirmed by the Senate, I will keep an open mind in every case, and I will always strive to preserve the Constitution of the United States and the American rule of law.
He's been criticized by some conservatives for an opinion he wrote on Obamacare that essentially, it's argued, Justice Roberts, adopted in upholding the constitutionality of Obamacare. But it was really an exercise. I see this as, and we'll get John Malcolm's interpretation of this as well as Randy Barnett's later in the show, two experts in this arena. But it was really an exercise of judicial restraint. On the issue of the individual mandate and the whole question of whether or not it was a tax, Kavanaugh did write in his dissent that the Obamacare individual mandate was, quote, a law that is unprecedented on the federal level in American history, that it would, quote, that it presented, quote, a jarring prospect, unquote, and would, quote, usher in a significant expansion of congressional authority with no obvious principled limit. So he did open the door. He did express the concerns, and he did open the door to the individual mandate and what that meant, opened a door to a constitutional challenge to Obamacare. But he essentially, in his dissent, exercised the restraint to say it shouldn't be preemptorily adjudicated prior to its imposition and left it to the high court. That's not the same thing as being some kind of backdoor defender of Obamacare, which he clearly was not. So I think that criticism of him from conservatives is not well-founded.
Do you think he has to worry about anything else?
Oh, there's this one.
Are they going to keep digging deep? I mean, obviously, he seems to be a solid family man, good husband, great father.
If he wasn't taken.
I mean, really.
Here's the one thing. That this is going to be sort of interesting. This will be an interesting moment for him. I'm sure he'll be prepared for it. But
what have you discovered?
Well,
who did he go to prom with, or did he not go to prom?
I didn't discover this. Robert Costa at the Washington Post reported it that there's a passage in a David Brock book from 2002, "Blinded by the Right," which explains
"Blinded by the Right." Wrapped up like a douche, you know the roaring. That song?
You can't say that word on the air. What did you say?
No, you know what?
That's gross. You're disgusting. Brett Kavanaugh would not be in your presence. David Brock's 2002 book, Blind by the Right, that explains his, conversion from the right to the left. In his book, David Brock, I'm not going to repeat the title.
Right.
His
Blinded by the Right.
Yes. What is it?
That's the thing. I
wrapped up like a what?
That was my Blinded by the light.
Wrapped up like a deuce.
I
said deuce.
Deuce.
I said deuce.
That's not what you said.
That was one of my first 45s.
We'll have Brett Kavanaugh adjudicate this case before he's seated.
What's really in the song?
Whether or not you can stay on the airwaves. Recalling 1997 State of the Union watch party at Laura Ingraham's house.
Oh, boy.
I was not invited.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Brock claimed he saw Kavanaugh mouth the word bitch. Am I allowed to say that? I mean, I guess if you said what you said, I could say it. It's just about anything.
I didn't say what you said.
Brock claimed he saw Kavanaugh mouth the word bitch when a camera fan to then First Lady Hillary Clinton. Did you or did you not mouth the word
biatch
in response to our beloved former First Lady during the State of the Union address in 1997, Mr. Brock?
That question! And what do you think of your wife? Because his lovely wife will be sitting behind him like Louise Gorsuch sat behind him.
Have you no shame, Senator?
What did you mean?
Durbin. Yeah, so...
Honestly, do you think that's going to come up in his confirmation hearing?
These dumb senators, you don't think a Kamala Harris or a Dick Durbin or a DiFi is going to ask him about this? Absolutely, it's going to come up. I can't wait for this. What he should... here's what I would suggest. Lean into it.
Oh, yeah? Sir, did you or did you... All right, let's role play. I'm Dick Durbin, a very good-looking Dick Durbin. Did you or did you not... repeat those words when the TV panned to Hillary Clinton. Did you say the B word?
I did not mouth that word.
What did you say then? Answer the question.
I didn't say anything.
Answer the question.
I didn't mouth the word. The question is, the allegation is I mouthed the word. I did not mouth that word.
Well, then what were you doing?
I said that word. I said it repeatedly. I had a couple of belts, and then I went even more blue. You know why? Because she's a disgrace, Senator. She should be in prison. My first act as a Supreme Court justice will be to launch my own independent prosecution of Hillary Clinton. And I don't care whether she and Bill are flying commercial or private. Is he knitting? What is he doing?
He's reading a book, but he has a pillow lap. Hmm. Right? I know. I saw that. I watched that 30 seconds.
So that's the
what happened? Their private jet broke down?
Yeah. So that's first they couldn't pay for the mortgages, and now they can't pay to fly private. Not that this was staged or anything.
You know, that's sitting in the first row and first class.
Maybe the tip-off for me was the photographic attribution, Uma Abedin. I thought maybe this is staged.
You've made the switch, and it feels so good. You've switched to Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560. The Answer. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560. The Answer.
Good morning, Dan and Amy. We'll get back to Brett Kavanaugh in just a minute, but we've got another sort of Me Too case for the P-Hat posse potentially to pounce upon, and that's next door. Curtis Hill, we've had him on the show before. He's the Attorney General of Indiana. He's in a bit of hot water, potentially. There are allegations that are being leveled against him.
Yeah, allegations were made public after an internal investigation. A legislative memo was leaked to the media last week, and it talks about this little party that went on last March in Indianapolis after the legislative session ended. You know, everybody goes out and they have parties and they do karaoke. It's a big moment. And in the early morning hours after this party, one lawmaker from Munster, Indiana, says that Curtis Buttocks leaned in toward
Curtis Hill.
Curtis
Hill. Curtis Buttocks.
Curtis Hill.
Get your mind out of the gutter. First the blinded by the light reference, now this.
She said he leaned in toward her, put his hand on her back, slid it down, and grabbed her buttocks.
Why are
you
laughing?
She then told him to back off. But he approached her again later in the evening and put his hand on her back and said, "That skin, that back."
Okay. And
dramatic reading.
And the response from Curtis Hill and other legislators has been what?
Well, they are asking for him to resign.
Who's they?
The governor of Indiana and other.
Eric Holcomb has called for him to resign.
Yep. And other lawmakers. So he had a press conference yesterday. He did not take any questions from reporters and he was defending himself.
These past several days have witnessed my name and reputation dragged through the gutter in ways I would have never imagined. Apparently, in this climate, the standard is guilty, and who cares if you're innocent?
I mean, that's the truth. Does he deserve to tell his side of the story? 312-642-5600 is a turnkey .pro answer line.
Curtis Hill is a married man?
Yes, he's married. He's a Republican, been in the Republican Party, considered a rising star, former Elkhart County prosecutor. Also an Elvis impersonator who has
doesn't usually work out well for Elvis impersonators in high office. I think we've got some experience with that here.
Yeah, but they say if Hill does not resign, majority Republicans can take action on him to remove him.
And it's one allegation at this point.
No, it's three allegations. Three staffers and two lawmakers claim that he was handsy, but all seemed to happen at that one party.
Well, wait, he groped five people at one party?
He was very busy. Yes.
Three staffers and two lawmakers all say they were groped by Curtis Hill at the same party.
At the same party.
And these are all, I mean, you know, you have to look at everything with a bit of a jaundiced eye. Are these all Democrats?
You know what? The staffers, I don't know what their political affiliation is, but one's a Democratic rep. Mara Candelia Reardon. Do you know her?
No.
And Gabrielle McLemore. Those two are Indiana State Democrats.
McLemore?
Or maybe that, yes.
Name assassinator? I mean, honestly, we need to get phonetics spellings of every name that is going to be uttered on this show if you're going to be in charge of uttering it.
Hear about the big stories of the day, then talk about them right here on Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer.
Good morning, Dan and Amy. Well, it took a while for this movie to not so much get made, but find a distributor. Certainly the popular streaming services like Amazon and Netflix weren't interested. I wonder if their lack of interest was politically motivated, because it's a huge story that was suppressed as much as was possible by the D.C. press corps. We're talking about the story of Kermit Gosnell, who is an abortionist and murderer, who is serving what amounts to a life sentence now in Pennsylvania for the murder of three infants born alive during abortions that he murdered, and one of his adult patients also murdered at this Philadelphia House of Horrors abortion mill that he operated. A movie has been made. It's started not shortly after was written and began production shortly after he was convicted in 2014. Big name as a star, Dean Cain,
really?
Superman.
Oh, yeah.
But it took a long time to get distribution until right before Independence Day. It was announced by the filmmakers that they have distribution, and they're going to be in 750 theaters around the country starting this October. And given the backdrop of what is going to be one of the preeminent issues debated with respect to the confirmation of Brett Kavanaugh, the timing couldn't be better. We're pleased to be joined by one of the filmmakers responsible for this movie, Gosnell, The Untold Story of America's Most Prolific Serial Killer. She is Anne McElhaney, and she joins us now. Anne, thanks for being with us again. Appreciate it.
It's good to be here. Thanks so much. Yeah, we're really happy. And as you say, the timing couldn't be better for this movie.
So this is based on a book you wrote about Gosnell, correct, the movie?
That's right. We wrote a book called Gosnell, The Untold Story of America's Most Prolific Serial Killer, which became a New York Times bestseller, sold out in 3 days. We got invited to the White House. It's a shocking story. When we started making the movie and doing interviews and talking to the cops and talking to the prosecutors, you know, we realized that a lot of the stuff that actually happened green, you could never make a film showing that stuff. So that's why we wrote the book. So that, you know, for anyone listening who thinks, oh my God, I could never go and see this movie, it's exactly the opposite. We were very careful to make the movie something that everyone could watch, that families could watch, that, you know, kids as young as 12 could watch. We've just, you know, exactly. So that's basically, that was always our intention. But the book is, the book is different to that.
Well, and you got Dean Cain, who's dreamy. I'll go watch it just for Dean Cain. But Dean Cain.
No, he's fabulous. He plays the lead. He plays the lead in the film. He plays Detective Jim Wood.
How did you get him to sign on to this film with him understanding what potentially the political implications would be for him in Hollywood?
Yeah, I mean, I think he's a brave guy, and I think he's courageous. He was on very quickly, actually. He was no reluctance on his part. And I can tell you, most of the actors that we approached, that was not their answer to us.
Okay.
So, I mean, in the case of Dean, he was very fast to sign up, and we were really grateful. Well, he's wonderful.
What actors did you approach that turned down the role?
I don't think I'm allowed to say exactly
who
did that.
Right,
but I can tell you it happened. It happened a lot. And people, we even had cases where people said, oh, I'm going to do it. And then like 4 days later, they'd obviously gone home, thought about it, talked to friends and said, oh, I forgot, I'm going on a road trip during that time. You know, and people literally were coming up with, the dog at my homework sort of stuff. Like the most ludicrous, and we had that like many, many times.
Well,
we've got a great cast. We have Nick Searcy as well, who a lot of your listeners
Justified.
Know. Nick Searcy, who is in Justified, a member of the films that, you know, were nominated for Oscars last year, and he's also the director of the film. And we have Sarah James, another actor a lot of people would know. It's quite a star-studded cast. I mean, you know, we raised the money by crowdfunding. I don't know if you remember that. We did this massive crowdfunding campaign. broke all kinds of records. 29,000 people in the end paid $2.3 million to make this movie happen. And then Hollywood decided they didn't want us to ever, you know, let it ever see the light of day.
Well, it's funny, too, not funny, but rather ironic, because I remember after Gosnell was convicted, Planned Parenthood put out a statement essentially saying, oh, well, this guy was terrible, of course. And we, of course, don't condone anything that he did, but that has nothing to do with safe, legal abortion and so forth. But doesn't it say something about the unwillingness to confront what Gosnell did, the murders that he committed, the unwillingness to really confront them by ostensible pro-choicers or these pro-abort organizations like Planned Parenthood? Doesn't that say something about them?
It says so much about them. I mean, there's so much about what they said in their statement that's just completely wrong. I mean, here's a situation where this guy was well known to be up to no good. Let's put it that way. And two women died. So two women died in the clinic. And during that time when two women died, the Department of Health in Pennsylvania, 17 years passed. During those 17 years, when unbelievable reports of atrocities happening there were being constantly reported to the Department of Health, no one inspected in 17 years. Even when this story came to light, the media wouldn't report on it. Planned Parenthood had one of the inspectors, an abortion inspector, had gone in to this clinic at one point, said it was the worst place they'd ever been to. The National Abortion Federation had sent someone in there. You know, these are all the Planned Parenthood type people. Sent someone in there to inspect the place. Said it was the worst place they'd ever been. Came out, didn't tell anyone. Didn't tell the cops, didn't report it. You know, hospitals around Philadelphia knew this was going on, and no one did anything about it. Even when they raided the clinic, the night that they eventually raided the clinic and caught up with this guy, they allowed him to continue aborting babies while they were there, while there were cats walking across the floor, while they had discovered fetuses, lots of them, babies' bodies, in the basement. And they let him continue. And you know why they let him continue? Why? The Department of Health said to them, let him continue to work. And lots of your listeners know what these departments of health around the country are like. They'd close a restaurant if they found a piece of dust, you know. You're trying to run a wee bar, run a little business. Oh, no, the Department of Health shut you down overnight. But they allowed him to continue to do these abortions, even in those conditions. I mean, the story is unbelievable, and it's about time people knew about it. Right. I mean, I've had the experience of, you know, going somewhere, getting my hair done, and someone saying, what do you do? And I say, oh, my God, I'm going to tell them the story. I tell them the story. People have never heard of him.
Yeah,
well,
right.
In their defense, Fox News, Brett Baer on Fox News did do an hour-long special on Kermit Gosnell, and it was so horrifying. I felt as if I was watching a horror film. So you said that we can take kids as young as 12 to your movie. How is that possible that you, I mean, I applaud you for doing it, but how did you do that?
Well, you know, I mean, there's ways of doing things. We don't show anything. We never show anything. And so I would say to people, anyone trying to work out, like, could I go and see this? If you can watch, you know, Law, I mean, this is like a Law and Order episode. Obviously, what they're describing, what they talk about, mm-hmm. you know, is abortion, but you don't see anything. And I can tell you, know, we've had people go, and I've had this is one of the things that's important for us, because we've been talking to audiences, and people have said, oh, I'm scared. I really don't know if I could ever go and see that. And they've gone and seen it and said, no, there's no problem. You can totally see this. It's upsetting, but it's not horrific, because you never see anything.
When you, the name of your book and the name of the film, The Untold Story of America's Most Prolific Serial Killer. I mean, people think of serial killers and they think of John Wayne Gacy or Ted Bundy, Jeffrey Dahmer. Why do you describe Gosnell this way?
Because for sure, he killed more people than all of those names combined. And we know this. And it's not us saying this. The grand jury who spent a year investigating this case said he killed thousands and thousands of babies. In fact, one of the ABC journalists, you know, who investigated, eventually investigated the story, said this guy is probably the biggest serial killer in American history. But you know what? If you look on Wikipedia, you won't find him on any list of serial killers. We're going to change all that. Mm. Here was a guy who, you know, induced women to give birth to babies so that babies were born alive. They lived, many of them lived quite a while because he wasn't often there. And he had these untrained staff just filling women up with these drugs that would induce the babies to be born alive. And then they would lie there and wait till Gosnell came or someone came to snip their necks with scissors. And this went on for so long, why we confidently say, you know, that he was America's biggest serial killer. He is.
It seems like it took a lot longer to get a distributor than it did to get the money to raise the film make the film. What was that process like, and how did you ultimately secure the distributor that you did so that people can see this?
Oh God! I mean, it's almost like another story in itself. I mean, we'll have to write the book of that someday. I mean, when we originally made the movie and showed it, like we showed it to an agent in Hollywood who said, "Oh, this is great. This film's great. You know, you're gonna have no problem, you know, getting distribution." And then he went around all the major distribution houses, all over Hollywood, and no one said the film wasn't good. In fact, they said the very opposite. Many of them said, "Oh my God, this is extraordinary. This is an amazing story." Yeah, but we couldn't show it. It wouldn't be for us. Too controversial. You know, these are people who say that their whole lifeblood is controversy.
Right.
But no, we all know why they didn't want to show this film. And in the end, what we had to do was we had to raise a lot of money. And, you know, and we found a distribution company who are working with us. But, you know, it wasn't easy. And we had to do the harder route, like, which is what you have to do often with independent story. With this story, the hurdles have been just, you know, incessant. I mean, it's, you know, we made the movie four years ago, and you know it has taken this long, and we weren't you know, we weren't sitting back in our oxters. We have just tried absolutely everything, but thank God. I mean, 750 screens. It's going to start on 750 screens, 12th of October. Everyone, please save the date, 12th of October. And what really needs to happen now is every theater needs to be packed. Every theater needs to be packed out that night for that whole weekend. People can buy out a whole theater. If you really, you know, if you're listening and inspired by this, you make sure everyone you've ever heard of fills that theater and sends a message.
And
so, this story needs to be known. It's an incredible story.
It is.
He's in jail forever.
It's an incredible book that you wrote, and I'm sure this has been, as you say, turned into a compelling movie. October 12th is the date. People want to track this, make sure they understand where the theaters are that are showing it. Is there a website they can go to?
Absolutely. They can go to gosnellmovie.com. Just go to gosnellmovie.com. It'll bring you to a website. You can, you know, give your email address there, and we'll keep you constantly informed of exactly where the theaters are near you.
The website Gosnell, G-O-S-N-E-L-L, gosnellmovie.com. She is the author and one of the filmmakers, Anne McElhaney. The movie coming out October 12th. Remember that day, Gosnell, the untold story of America's most prolific serial killer. Anne, thanks so much for joining us. Good luck with the film.
Thank you so much for having me. God bless. Bye.
Bye. And she joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
It's news, opinion, insight. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560. The Answer.
Dan and Amy, picking up the discussion about that Gosnell movie coming out October 12th. The related story. Illinois taxpayer-funded abortions increased at least 274% in the first 6 months of 2018, thanks to Governor Rauner signing HB 40, which is the taxpayer financing of abortion on demand in this state, the biggest pro-abortion move of any governor in the history of America, against the backdrop of Brett Kavanaugh, against the backdrop of the Gosnell movie. Peter Breen, who state rep and House Republican floor leader, he, like all other 72 legislative Republicans in the Illinois General Assembly, voted against the legislation the governor signed with Democrats, said by the time the program gets ramped up, these numbers are going to be 10 times what these preliminary numbers are. So even if you're pro-choice, this is why there's a supermajority of Illinoisans that oppose this. It's just the radical left, including Governor Rauner, that supports it. Because even if you are for it, you don't necessarily want your money to go finance it.
No, I mean, I have friends that are pro-choice who said, what is this?
Right.
Our tax dollars are paying for people's abortions?
A new open-ended entitlement program in a state that is bankrupt financially, morally, and in every other conceivable way. This is what has come out of a Republican governor with the Democrat General Assembly and Republican opposition to it. So just against that backdrop, so you understand why maybe there's a little bit the enthusiasm for Governor Rauner's reelection is a little bit lacking.
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer.
If you're talking about it, I'll be talking about it. Dennis Prager here. Join me this morning at 11, right here on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. What should Father Flager do? My candidate for mayor, by the way. What should Father Flager do for an encore to the Dan Ryan shutdown this weekend? The evil Knievel of the Catholic Church, if you will. What is the next stunt that he should pull, or the next catastrophe he should induce? Want your suggestions. 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line. 64636DA, turnkey.pro text line. Think big. I mean, don't just think ground transportation. We've got waterways.
Right.
We got the skies. We will soon have pneumatic tubes, courtesy of Elon Musk. So think big.
The boring company. Yeah, because there is, Father Flager came out yesterday and said he's going to plot his next move, which he says will be bigger and more dramatic than shutting down the Dan Ryan Expressway. That just wasn't enough. That was just a little taster, a little appetizer, so to speak.
You know, I think the governor needs to understand that civil disobedience is doing things that the mainstream feel are not acceptable. It's a fundamental failure on the elected officials in the state and in Chicago.
All the gun violence that's going on.
Well,
the
I mean, he's, is there... well, he's right about that. He's right about it. It's a fundamental failure of the government to not provide for the physical security of its constituents. He's right about that.
So he wants something done because obviously Dan Ryan takeover didn't work. I mean, still four people were murdered.
Five and 35.
Well, they changed it down to
It didn't work. Oh, boy, that's shocking. Here, well, let's see. What should he do, though? What should he do? What if he got a bunch of disco records together from the 70s?
And hired he put, Steve Dahl.
Put them in center field at Comiskey Park or the G-Spot and blew them up during a Sox. He actually doesn't need to do it in between Sox games. He could do it during a Sox game.
Yeah.
What about that?
Well, there is some talk of possibly shutting down a runway at O'Hare Airport. And I'm not kidding.
That's pretty good.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Really? That's dangerous. And Governor Rauner spoke yesterday. He went from Twitter to television.
Just as no one should walk onto a runway at O'Hare Airport, no one should walk onto an interstate expressway.
Oh, there you go. Is that a dare?
See? Did he feed him an idea by saying O'Hare Airport, a runway?
Let's see. I'm trying to just work out the logistics here. So how many people do we need to shut down 14 right, 32 left?
Well, 1,000 took five lanes.
Yeah, you
want to
You got to think about the crisscrossing runways.
Well, yeah, and the parallel runways too.
Which
one? Because you're
plus,
pilot.
Plus, maybe you shut down. Maybe you do a terminal shutdown as well as a runway shutdown.
Oh,
maybe
so
you shut down
into...
a terminal in one area and a runway like at the international terminal.
What
so you
about
shut
midway?
Down international flights too.
What about Midway Airport? That'd be lot easier. Jump that fence there. Get your message out, carry your signs.
What if he
put people's lives in danger?
What if you had
again?
What if you had 1,000 people scale the Hancock Building like Spider Dan?
Oh yeah.
What about that? What if he crashed a blimp into DuSable Bridge? Something like that. What if he got a bunch of people from Western Electric for a company outing, and he capsized the boat in the river at the dock? What about? I'm trying to. You know, I mean, he's got to be big.
It's got to be big.
It's got to be bigger than shutting down the Dan Ryan. That was big.
312-642-5600 is our turnkey.pro answer line.
Jerry and Palatine.
Hey, I think that he should try self-immolation. That ought to get a nice story.
Sure. Very Vietnam era. Thanks for the call, Jerry.
Okay.
John in Palatine.
Hi, Dan and Amy. I think it would be kind of playful if Father Flager and all of his activists jumped in the Buckingham Fountain and disrupted the sightseeing.
Okay. They're not really a playful group.
Bird bath.
Okay, thanks for the call, John. Let's see.
No, what they could, because Lakeshore Drive's been done before. That's old. Dan Ryan, if he could do Kennedy at the junction right there, but I mean, somebody eventually, if they keep doing this, somebody is going to die.
What if they took over the Sea Dog, and then they went and they rammed into all the boats in the playground and sunk them?
Oh, in the playpen area?
Yeah. The playpen.
And just hit different boats.
Yeah, just knock all those revelers out. And
that does look
and
like
take
a party,
off.
Doesn't it? Have what you ever been in that? There? The playpen?
Let's
I'm
see.
Sorry.
What if he put everybody in a CTA bus, and if he went under 55 miles an hour, the bus was going to blow up?
Okay, speed. I don't know. I mean, I think the biggest thing they could do is a runway at O'Hare or Midway. And I think they'd start with Midway, and then if that didn't work, then take it to O'Hare.
What if they wouldn't let – they just took over the Ferris wheel at Navy Pier? That's the number one tourist attraction. And they wouldn't let anybody else on the Ferris wheel for the entire
it's
weekend.
Too dangerous. We'd stop violence in Chicago. Why are you here? It's dangerous here. What could they do?
Steve in Hinsdale.
Well, what's odd is that Flager is the most dynamic black man in Chicago. Once the black community realizes he's white and not black, then they'll get rid of him.
Yeah.
But he's leading the black community, and they're following in his footsteps. Very sad situation. Thanks. Have a great day.
Thanks for the call, especially since he's ripped from the pages of the Archie cartoon series. Mike and Northside.
Hey, good morning. I would encourage Father Faker to go and take over one of the runways or the terminals. Go ahead, you loser. Because if he does, that gives Trump reason to federalize the Illinois National Guard, take it over.
Please.
Yeah.
And then... Well, listen, because then Chicago will lose all the graft and corruption at O'Hare and Midway Airport.
Right. Yeah, okay.
So go ahead, Flager, do it. And I just want to ask him one question. If crime is down, like Rahm and the police superintendent said, what are they marching for? Unemployment is down, Rahm said. Everybody's working in Chicago. What do they have to complain about? With a link card slate or something?
Oh, Mike.
All right, Mike.
Protesting gun violence.
You can't gotta do something novel.
Not a banner in the sky, not a
A banner in the sky. What if they did some sort of instead of the runway, what at the airspace level? And they did some kind of
blocked planes from landing.
Well, they did some kind of parachutist formation.
Oh, learned how to skydive and then
What if they imposed?
Skydived into...
What if they got a handful of small planes and they instituted a no-fly zone over O'Hare?
That would be.
I don't know how many pilots are in their ranks, but I'm just just spitballing. Dennis in Crystal Lake.
Hey Dan, I think it'd be coordinated. And lifted every single bridge at the same time downtown with people still on it, of course. And you would have a disruption second to none.
Hmm. Yeah, okay. Thanks for the call. I remember when the bridges were once lifted, like they were doing construction.
But weren't they simultaneously lifted at the same time?
Yeah, it felt like they were erecting a wall to keep you in. It felt like this was East Germany.
Yeah.
What if they did that? What if they built a wall around the city or dropped a dome like they did in that Simpsons movie over the city and nobody could leave?
Oh, now you're scaring me.
What about that?
Claustrophobic. Yeah, no.
Andy in Hinsdale.
The left loves to dox people. So I think what would be really effective, get Flager and several of his crews to go camp out in front of the homes of Rahm Emanuel and all the aldermen. Emanuel is the CEO, the aldermen are all the board of this city. Get people's attention to where these guys live. Because this is what they would do to someone on the right who's completely ineffective in their job. I got to tell you, I lived here my whole life. I am so tired of driving through Fallujah on the lake. Father Flakey's, he's definitely a low out there, but... I like the fact that he is trying to do something because every other leader in this city has just thrown up their hands or turned their backs on this problem. And I'm sick of 3,000 to 5,000 people getting shot every year in the city. It's a disgrace.
It is a disgrace. Thanks for the call, Andy. And, yeah, it is interesting. Gosh, maybe somebody, an enterprising reporter in the Chicago Press Corps. I'm kidding. That'll never happen.
Yeah,
but would ask Rahm a tough question about that, or Flager a tough question about Rahm, that is. Well, once you take it right to the mayor's doorstep, is it because you're flacking for Rahm like you did in 2015 during his reelection? Remember that, Father Flager?
Father Flager knows where he lives.
So, but I mean, are you just, is this just a minstrel show for Rahm? Is that what this is, Father Flager? Or are you speaking truth to power? I'm confused. It'd be interesting to get a response from him. I mean, not that anybody in the Chicago Press Corps will ask. I understand. Bob in Oswego.
Hey, guys. Good morning.
Good morning.
Hey, I was thinking if he wants to really sacrifice something, maybe he should have a public flogging of himself. It'd be the Flager flogging, and then he could sell tickets to it. I would pay for it.
All right. Thanks for the call, Bob.
Jeez.
Yeah, flogging. A little violence. Mark in Glen Ellen.
Yeah. Hey, Dan and Amy. I was thinking maybe Father Flager could actually maybe do a Bible study. Maybe that would help.
Okay. Yeah. All right. Thanks for the call.
I think he's prayed on it, Mark, for a long time, and nothing's changing.
I don't think it's about praying. I think Mark's point is about teaching people the word so that they live lives absent violence.
The time that they spent walking a mile and a half down the Dan Ryan, they could have cleaned up 10 parks. They could have done something for the community, you know, painted someone's house, that built a house with Habitat for Humanity. Who knows?
Yeah.
Well,
yawn.
I don't know if it was time well spent.
Ralph and Rantoul.
Yeah, good morning. Amy, they could have taken garbage bags with them and picked up the mile and a half of the Dan Ryan. You know, the blocking O'Hare, I think that's a great idea. Why not, since it's always about the kids, Father Flukeworm could tie a bunch of kids to weather balloons and kind of hover them over the airspace. So you couldn't pop the balloons because then the kids would plummet down onto the tarmac.
Yeah.
So, just float a bunch of kids in balloons. Yeah.
Good idea. Kids in balloons. It's good, Ralph. Thanks for the call. Paul in Lake Forest.
Hey, good morning, guys. Great topic. Just to get off the topic for 1 second, Dan, you've disagreed with me a long time about this, and I'm going to say you're right. I've been saying that Rahm is letting these guys kill each other on the South Side in an attempt to get gun control, but I was corrected last night, and that he just wants them all to leave because the Chinese are buying up the South Side. And I did some research, and that is true. They're buying up Bronzeville, stuff like that. Just to address your topic, I think they should march on the homes of all the absent fathers. So break off into little groups of two and three and go to the homes of all the absent fathers, because that's what the problem is on the South Side.
Yeah, well,
a lot of the fathers you can't find.
Thanks for the call, Paul. Yeah,
so if we know where they live.
Well, the point is well taken, though, and I'm sure many of them you can find. And that would be interesting. It's a little bit of cultural shaming, probably more powerful than a politician's rhetoric or a politician pretending to be a priest. You might be onto something there.
Listen to podcasts of Dan and Amy from the AM 560 mobile app. Download it today at 560theanswer.com/mobile.
Some breaking news. All 12 boys and their coach have been rescued from that flooded cave in Thailand.
Oh, that's good.
That's good. But quickly, if you're hungry today, everybody likes a free meal. Today's Cow Appreciation Day. So over there at Chick-fil-A, if you wear any cow costume, if you're a furry, you have a cow costume, or any cow spotted accessory, you can get a free meal from now until 7 p.m. I'm going to wear the cow guy's jacket.
Scott the cow guy shillelagh. You'll probably be behind him in line.
No, because remember he gave us those jackets. So I'm going to wear that and get a free meal.
Congratulations. This is a big day for you.
This is a very big day.
That's nice.
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. President Trump made the big announcement in primetime yesterday. It's going to be Judge Brett Kavanaugh.
In keeping with President Reagan's legacy, I do not ask about a nominee's personal opinions. What matters is not a judge's political views, but whether they can set aside those views to do what the law and the Constitution require. I am pleased to say that I have found, without doubt, such a person. Tonight, it is my honor and privilege to announce that I will nominate Judge Brett Kavanaugh to the United States Supreme Court.
And I think what you will learn from even a cursory review of Kavanaugh's record is that he is the rare combination of originalist philosophy, intellectual prowess, academic credentials, and then what you saw last night when he was announced, political savvy.
Oh, yeah. I mean, he
rare
he,
combination of all of those things.
He made us like him. I mean, he was likable on a number of levels. He's philanthropic. He, you know, feeds the homeless through Catholic Charities. He's a coach. He's a great dad. His daughters genuinely seem to love their father.
It was him spinning the personal narrative for people who don't know him, which is virtually everybody outside the Beltway, and for the press, and to inform his conversation with the senators, and ultimately to inform the brutal confirmation he is going to go through with those senators. So talking about his parents, that, yeah, he may be some white bread kid from a successful professional family, but he learned some things along the way, including from his parents.
I was lucky. My mom was a teacher. In the 1960s and 70s, she taught history at two largely African-American public high schools in Washington, D.C., McKinley Tech and H.D. Woodson. Her example taught me the importance of equality for all Americans.
And then his mom was a trailblazer in the law.
One of the few women prosecutors of that time, she overcame barriers and became a trial judge. The president introduced me tonight as Judge Kavanaugh. But to me, that title will always belong to my mom.
I mean, stop it. I'm crying over here, honestly.
And then again,
it touched women's hearts.
Honestly. No, I mean, and you want to know about the guy. People right. want to know about him. So there's nothing wrong with that. That's who he is. That's who his family is. That's great.
And he made the point that he said that, you know, when he was in charge, he hired mostly law clerks who are women.
Right. Another kind of political sop, as was right. this, the invocation of one another right. Supreme Court justice.
For the past 11 years, I've taught hundreds of students, primarily at Harvard Law School. I teach that the Constitution's separation of powers protects individual liberty. And I remain grateful to the dean who hired me, Justice Elena Kagan.
Zing. And then lastly, how he captured your vote, Senator Jacobson, was his prowess when it comes to coaching girls basketball.
For the past 7 years, I have coached my daughter's basketball teams. The girls on the team call me Coach K.
That's awesome.
You see what he did there?
I am.
Or the
well,
girls
that's what they
did?
Come. I mean, and then yeah. you know, he went on to say that they won the city championship this year.
There's no question.
CYO basketball. I mean, I hope he continues to coach. Maybe he'll be busy.
He's going to have a full docket.
Well,
but
maybe in the summer months he could do it.
See if he can't work it in. Maybe have some of his clerks as assistant coaches. For more on this topic, we're pleased to be joined again by Randy Barnett, who's a Georgetown law professor by way of Chicago, we should add. Also the author of the book, Our Republican Constitution, Securing the Liberty and Sovereignty of We the People. Randy, thanks for joining us again. Appreciate it.
Good morning, Dan. Good morning, Amy.
Well, one of the things that you have said, we've talked to you about a number of justices and the run-up to the selection of the nominees before. One of the things you've said, if you were counseling presidents, is pick somebody with a record. Don't play the politician's game. Let's pick somebody who has no record so then nobody will know. Actually, pick somebody with a record so you do have an indication of what their judicial philosophy is. And President Trump did that by selecting Brett Kavanaugh, didn't he?
Yes, I think that's what gave him the edge inside the process over other very appealing and attractive judges who did not have a long judicial record or whose record of decision-making didn't really apply to cases of the kind that would reveal their judicial philosophy. So that's, I think that is one of the things that gave him a huge edge in this process.
Some those on the left, Chuck Schumer, said they have a problem with, in one of his decisions, he talked about presidents should be shielded from litigation while in office. They see that as a way of him, you know, protecting President Trump. Do you think that that is going to come up during his confirmation hearings?
Oh, sure. And that was an opinion that he rendered, that he gave before he was a judge, I think, actually, as I recall. He's got an the problem with a really long record like this is that he's got a lot of, you got a lot of stuff to try to learn and keep in mind. Including his tenure when he worked in the Bush administration White House, his tenure when he worked for Ken Starr as this special prosecutor, and then his tenure as a judge. So there's a lot there, and there's going to be a lot of muckraking through all of that stuff, and the document review process is going to be very, very challenging for the Republicans to decide, and for the administration to have to review documents and decide what can be turned over and what's executive privileged and can't be turned over. It's going to be, that's going to be one of the downsides or the costs of this particular pick.
But again, going back to the upsides, you've got case law that is on point on a number of issues that are important, you know, to, with respect to the legislative process, important to the American people. He has held forth on Second Amendment individual right to self-protection in the Heller case and the extension of it. He's held, he has dissented from a majority opinion on the issue of immigration with respect specifically to H-1B visas. He has weighed in on religious liberty. He's weighed in to some extent on Obamacare. So there is sort of clear lines that have been drawn, also clear instances of judicial restraint, even where perhaps some conservatives would have wanted him to go further in a particular case, like the Obamacare-related case, and he didn't because he didn't believe the case was ripe for adjudication at his level. So there is a lot there for conservatives to rally around, even though he's seen as sort of an inside-the-beltway player.
Yeah, I agree with you about all those cases except what you say about his Obamacare decision, where I just, you know, I was there and I heard oral argument in that case and heard him at oral argument in that case. And I really, really strongly disagreed with his opinion. And that was one of the things that I think that opinion, I think, is one of the reasons why he was not on the original Trump list. He was added later when they supplemented the list after the election. They added five judges and he was one of them. And the thought was they added five judges so that he would be one of them. And I think he was not on the original list because of that Obamacare decision. It really was pretty bad. But look, he's got a very long record. You can't be judged entirely on the basis of one decision. And what's going to happen now is going to be political theater because the Democrats have already made it clear and their interest groups have already made it clear that they would oppose any justice, any judge, that President Trump would pick in much the same way that the Republicans would oppose any judge that Obama picked in the last year of his presidency, which is why they didn't hold any hearings, because hearings would have been superfluous. They wouldn't have been about Merrick Garland at all. Anything that was said about Merrick Garland at such a hearing would have been a pretext. It wouldn't have been what was really going on. Now we're going to hear a lot of pretextual arguments about Brett Kavanaugh that won't be what's really going on. And what's really going on is denying Trump any additional Supreme Court justices.
Right. Now, I want to go back to this Obamacare decision, because this is being kicked around by proponents of Kavanaugh as well as opponents of him, including the American Family Association came out and suggested conservatives oppose Kavanaugh's nomination because of that case and because they didn't feel he went far enough in the Priest for Life case. And I disagree with them on that. One of the arguments that was made in a piece in The Federalist by a former clerk of Kavanaugh's is that his dissent in the Obamacare case, the mandate case, his dissent from Judge Silberman's majority opinion was still included language that the individual mandate, Obamacare, a law that is unprecedented at the federal level in American history, jarring prospect, would usher in a significant expansion of congressional authority with no obvious principal limit. So that's not exactly a defense of Obamacare, the individual mandate. That was an argument that it should be brought in the future until it was imposed, right?
I think, I read that Federalist piece. That was an unduly puff piece about Kavanaugh's opinion. I don't think it fairly reflects what Kavanaugh was doing in that opinion.
Okay.
At that part of the opinion, Kavanaugh said that the law had, if it had any constitutional defects at all, he said under the tax power, they were relatively minor and would be quite easy for Congress to fix. Then he proposed three different ways that Congress could fix the law very easily. To make the individual mandate a constitutional tax. He didn't say it was a constitutional tax, but he said it was very close to being a constitutional tax. He did not say it wasn't a constitutional tax. And that's actually somewhat like what Justice Roberts did.
Right.
Justice Roberts ruled that because it was unconstitutional under the commerce power, it could still be construed as a tax. It was a reasonable construction to construe it as a tax, and therefore it might be construed that way. That's very close to what Brett Kavanaugh did in his – not exactly what he did, but it's very close to what he did.
Then he found
in the bulk of his dissent is that it was a tax for purposes of the Anti-Injunction Act. Now, that's technical because courts have held that a tax could be a tax for purposes of that statute and still not be a tax for purposes of the Constitution. Ultimately, that's what the Supreme Court – it didn't exactly say that in this case, but so there is a, he didn't call it a tax for purposes of the Constitution, but he came very, very close to providing John Roberts the roadmap to the roadmap to what he actually did.
Yeah. Okay. Well, that's a fair criticism. I mean, now Roberts made an argument that even Obama's lawyers didn't make, the federal government's lawyers didn't even make it in terms of manufacturing this into a tax, but you're suggesting that, The thinking that was presented by Kavanaugh could have easily informed Roberts to take that final step.
Well, actually, I have to disagree again. I think Don Varelli at oral argument, which is you're going to be forgiven for not knowing everything that was said in 8 hours of oral argument, Dan. But I think Don Varelli in oral argument did try to provide Obama this out. I mean, try to provide John Roberts this out.
Wasn't he arguing the alternative though? That wasn't the first offering they made, and then it was arguing this as another possibility.
Yeah, but that's all Roberts found. Roberts said the natural reading of the statute was that it was a penalty in enforcing a requirement, therefore it was a mandate, and that would be unconstitutional. He should have stopped there.
Right.
He should have said that's the natural reading of the statute. It's unconstitutional. We stop there. But he said, a reasonably possible reading of the statute is that it was a tax because the amount at issue was not coercive. And that's something else that Judge Kavanaugh did mention in oral argument in the Seven Sky case. So because it was reasonably possible he could read it that way, that's the move Roberts made. Kavanaugh did not make that move. That was not his move. But that was Roberts' move, and that's how he got – that's how he could both say it was unconstitutional under the commerce power and still uphold the law.
Oh, okay. No, all right. I just wanted to elucidate because this is a huge case. And as you point out, it could have been one of the things that was initially keeping Kavanaugh off the Leonard Leo et al. List. And so, you know, this is something that he may get questions on from conservatives, even though the focus, of course, is going to be the left coming at him over Roe v. Wade and things like that.
Yeah, but he's going to have answers that'll satisfy the senators. So
yeah.
Everything that happens now is going to be theater. Senators don't ask real questions anymore.
Right.
It's too bad they didn't figure out how to answer. They don't listen to what the answers are by and large. They're getting ready to ask their next question that staff has prepared for them. I wish that weren't the case. I've written articles about how the confirmation process can be improved by both sides, but I don't think that's going to happen this time around.
Well, what's your biggest recommendation? I mean, I know they're dog and pony shows, and I feel like the senators are just self-absorbed and want to make a name for themselves.
My biggest recommendation is they should stop asking about whether cases are right or wrong, the cases they like or the cases they hate are rightly or wrongly decided, and start asking nominees to explain to them how they understand particular clauses, what particular clauses mean in the Constitution. And that might reveal how they approach constitutional interpretation, which is what I think is a very important judicial qualification, is that their view of how to interpret the Constitution is part of your qualifications to be a judge.
Well, that's not as much fun as asking why do you hate women, you see. Other thing I want to get from you, though, is looking at this record of Kavanaugh's, I mean, do you feel comfortable making a guess as to whether he's going to be more like a Alito or Scalia or more like a Kennedy?
Look, I think all that I'm prepared to say is that he's replacing Justice Kennedy. And so his replacing Justice Kennedy, based on his record, is going to move the court in relative to where it is today, or in a originalist and textualist direction, because he is far more textualist and originalist than Justice Kennedy was, the person he's replacing. So that means overall the court will be moved in an originalist or textualist direction. Whether he ends up being more like John Roberts, which is also a possibility, or more like Justice Gorsuch, who he co-clerked with the same year at the court with Justice Kennedy, that I think is something that we're not going to find that out in the hearings, and we're only going to find that out once he gets on the high court.
From his record in terms of advancing originalist judicial philosophy, would you say that his holdings in cases involving the administrative state may be the best expressions of his commitment to originalism?
May or may not be a commitment to originalism. It's a commitment to what you might call the structural constitution, the separation of powers. He has a clear commitment to separation of powers, whether informed by originalism or not. He does have stuff like the Second Amendment case, the Heller 2 case, that is an originalist opinion. So I'm not saying he doesn't have any evidence of that.
Right.
But you can be informed by principles like separation of powers without being an originalist. He seems very interested and very committed to that. And I think the big draw to the White House really was his consistent harping on separation of powers and against the administrative state. That is what I think made him so appealing, that he overcame objections made against him of the kind we've already been discussing.
Okay. He is Randy Barnett, Georgetown Law Professor, author of the book Our Republican Constitution, Securing the Liberty and Sovereignty of We the People. Professor Barnett, thanks as always for joining us. Appreciate it.
It's always a pleasure with you guys.
Thank you.
Thank you. And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
There's only one radio show in Chicago talking about today's biggest stories and telling you what they really mean. That show is this one. Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer.
Dan and Amy, Nancy Pelosi gave an extended interview to Rolling Stone magazine in which she couldn't remember who the Senate Majority Leader is. That'd be Mitch McConnell.
She couldn't remember his name. Did she just not want to say his name?
No, she couldn't remember. She had to have a staffer remind her.
Honestly, that's that's scary.
That's actual audio from between Nancy Pelosi's ears. She also said this: "I'm really good at what I do. I'm a legislative virtuoso. I really love legislating." Somebody is rubbing off on Nancy Pelosi rhetorically, isn't he?
Yeah.
Legislative virtuoso, Nancy Pelosi. Good stuff.
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer.
They got the beat, the campus beat, the campus beat. Yeah, the campus beat.
I think we need to add the fisticuffs piece to that to make it a little bit more like actual campuses these days.
Oh, yeah.
The Go-Go's thing is a little bit too upbeat and not reflective of reality. And, of course, as we do in our Campus Beat segment, we don't limit it to college campuses because a lot of the totalitarianism abuse happens at the K-12 level, too, and that is the case here at a middle school, Lanier Middle School in Texas, where $50 went missing during the choir class's sixth grade field trip.
Ooh. Oh, and then everyone starts looking around. The old whodunit.
Mm-hmm. Well, they did more than looking around. They did more than...
Well, that's always happened when money's missing and then everyone thinks, ooh, who put their hands... Who stole from the cookie jar?
Yeah. Speaking of hands and the cookie jar... not a game of Clue here. The assistant principal ordered the choir's 22 female members, sixth grade girls,
okay,
to report to the school nurse for strip searches. 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro. Answer line 64636DA, turnkey.pro. Text line, you may want to fire in a...
sixth grade girls. They strip searched each and every one of them.
You may want to fire in a call to your school district about their policy for searching your kids after hearing this story. 22 sixth graders, members of the choir, ordered to report for strip searches. The nurse, I'm quoting from the record here, loosened their bras.
Oh, stop.
Checked around the waistband of their panties, quoting from the record, no money was found.
Did she go in everyone's pockets? I mean, that's the first thing you do before you make them take off their clothes or strip search them.
Well,
empty your pockets. What's in your purses? What's in your backpacks?
Okay. 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro. Answer line if you agree with the families who filed a federal lawsuit against the school district suggesting their kids' rights, constitutional rights, had been violated. A federal judge dismissed the lawsuit, but U.S. Court of Appeals for the Fifth Circuit reversed that decision last week. Reporting on this, just to understand the basis for doing anything as intrusive as this, there has to be reasonable cause before performing a search. So, yes, you don't have unfettered rights in a public school setting, but you do have some. And administrative searches by school personnel should be as non-intrusive as possible, and there has to be a reasonable belief contraband might be found. First of all, this was not illegal drugs or weapons. This was $50. Because it went missing doesn't mean it was stolen. Because it may have been stolen doesn't mean it was in any sixth grade girl's undergarments. So there's a lot of assumptions here that cut against the notion that this was anything approaching reasonable. Interestingly, despite the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals holding, the only discipline handed out for this mass violation of these girls' rights was a memo chastising the vice principal for performing a search to find something not actually considered to be contraband.
Well, so a school administrator came in to investigate. A school administrator went through their backpacks first, then they called in the school police officer, and he's the one that suggested that girls like to hide things in their bras and panties. Oh.
Yeah.
And that's when the school nurse came in, and they did this in the choir bathroom.
That the school resource officer? Excuse me. He's right up there with that Peterson guy down in Parkland. Not quite as severe, but... Yeah. That's not a school resource officer I want at my kid's school.
Yeah, girls like to hide money in their bras.
Yeah, here's a profed parenting tip.
Oh, I love profed parenting tips.
Oh, all right. You ready for this?
Okay. Should I write this one down?
If any adult at the school your kids goes to says girls like to hide things in their bras and panties, your girls shouldn't be going to that school.
It's time for Dan Prof's Parenting Tips. Whoa! Dan Prof's Parenting Tips. Whoa! Tell your kids to shut up and listen to him.
That's a child. That's a rare twofer. You got a campus beat and you got a prof parenting tip this morning, and there's no extra charge for that.
You know, I would actually have a hard time keeping my kid in that school. I would yank them. I'd start, you know. Wouldn't let them sing in the choir anymore.
If you, sixth grade girls, what, 12 years old, 11 years old?
10, 11, 12.
So if
some
you,
aren't wearing bras.
If you strip searched my 11-year-old over $50, I would have a hard time keeping my hands off of you.
Wow, your hypothetical children, they're 11 now, yeah. They're
growing up so fast.
I know.
Dan in Libertyville.
You know, if the money was never found on those girls, then the next logical step would have been to line up any choir teacher or school official that had any contact with that money and strip search them in the auditorium for all to see.
Sure, everybody strip. What is this, a Chicago public school? Thanks for the call, Dan. Thank you very much. Paul,
I mean, check their backpacks. Just have them empty out their pockets. They're going to put it in their bras.
Paul and Elgin.
Hey, good morning, go Hawkeyes. You know, this choir group, when they had the cast stolen, they kind of lost their harmony.
Oh.
All right. Have a good morning.
That was unfortunate.
I mean, they could have just even had a GoFundMe page to get $50 back. It's $50. It's not $500. That would be a felony. Anything over $300. It's $50.
Doesn't it say something about the disciplinary regime at some schools, though, like this apparently sex club school? How about you have kids the way I would run a school?
Yes.
If I was put in charge of a school, which probably will happen someday. honor code. Why don't you do it like West Point? You sign an honor code and you hold each other to an honor code. You can do that at the K through 12 level.
Yeah.
So the strip searches, really? It's absurd. Chip in St. Charles.
Yeah, Barack Obama advocates that they all strip down and shower together and they would have found the money then. That's what the Democrats do.
All right, thanks for the culture. You know, girls showering with boys and the whole thing. If you self-identify as a, you know what
he's
saying.
I just want to know who was the $50, and somebody knows something.
Yeah, okay.
Maybe it is a teacher. Maybe it is the choir director. Or maybe it's the vice principal.
Maybe it's Colonel Mustard in the study with a
wrench.
The candelabra.
Oh, got to go with a wrench.
Yeah.
Or the pipe.
All right.
The revolver.
How about one more? You know, there's just like a little bit of a greatest hits here. Mm-hmm. You like to do a stop, look, and listen every year or so. And since we just had graduations,
yes,
right, commencements and so forth, the Daily Caller did a nice little thing for us for this segment, put together some of the craziest professor tweets of this past school year. So
this is going to be good.
And the nice thing is, and I'm very proud of this, we've covered all of these. But let's take a walk down memory lane, shall we? Fresno, California State Fresno professor Randa Jarrar, remember her when First Lady Barbara Bush died?
Oh, yeah, that beast of a woman.
Barbara Bush was a generous and smart and amazing racist who, along with her husband, raised a war criminal. F out of here with your nice words. I'm happy the witch is dead. Can't wait for the rest of the family, rest of her family, to fall to their demise the way 1.5 million Iraqis have. English professor, Professor Jarrar. Austin Community College Professor Robert Ranko resigned from a position he held at a law firm after tweeting, "I'm not wishing for it, but I'd be okay if Betsy DeVos was sexually assaulted."
Okay. Dumb. I got a screw loose? What's wrong with people?
Yeah.
Go on. What else?
This is was a classic one. University of Pennsylvania teaching assistant Stephanie McKellop. She always calls on white men last, black women first. "I will always call on my black women students first. Other people of color get second-tier priority. White women come next, and if I have to, white men."
Oh, my gosh. See, did she get fired for that tweet?
She did not.
See, she should have been let go.
Mm.
Probably a tenured professor.
She's just a TA, but...
Oh, really? Oh, and they kept her on. Yeah.
And then
that's not biased behavior. Mm-hmm.
This was a good one too. Former Drexel professor George Maher, who subsequently left the school to become a scholar at New York University, made this remark on Twitter after the Las Vegas shooting. Mm-hmm. It's the white supremacist patriarchy, stupid, but liberals will drown out all discourse with a deafening chorus screeching gun control. White people and men are told that they're entitled to everything. This is what happens when they don't get what they want. The narrative of white victimization has been gradually built over the past 40 years. He also had previously said, "All I want for Christmas is white genocide." Yeah. These are some of the bright lights teaching our best and brightest at institutions of higher learning, which is why we bring you Campus Beat.
Connect with Dan and Amy on the AM 560 The Answer mobile app. Just text the word app to 64636 to download the app today.
We have this Baldwin thing straight now. Bieber is marrying a Baldwin, but it's not Alec Baldwin's daughter. It's Stephen Baldwin's daughter.
Right. Haley Baldwin. They just started dating, and all of a sudden they're engaged.
And
Justin Bieber, it looks like he's transitioning. What is he doing?
He looks like a character from Zoolander or something. Like he's some kind of androgynous model or something.
But
he's got this. He's got that weird Johnny Depp porn stash too.
Yeah, it's not a good look. And then tattoos all over his arms.
Wow, the Biebs. Updating this story.
As long as he's happy. Sorry.
That's true.
Honestly.
His happiness is the most important thing.
And I'm pulling for this young couple. I think they're going to make it.
I think they're going to make it 6 to 8 months.
They have the blessing. Oh, 6 to 8 months.
At least. Maybe, you know, 10. Oh. Is this Haley Baldwin?
No, it's Justin Bieber.
Oh. I can't really tell them apart, actually, because I think the one with long hair is taller. Which one is that? I want to update this story because we're going to track this. The Jim Jordan story, allegations that he knew about abuse of Ohio State wrestlers while he was an assistant coach and did nothing. Six former Ohio State University wrestling coaches offering support to Jordan. A letter signed by the head coach at the time, Russ Hellickson, and five assistant coaches said, "We all worked on the wrestling coaching staff during Jim's tenure at the Ohio State University. None of us saw or heard of abuse of OSU wrestlers. The well-being of student athletes was all of our concern. If we had heard any of the abuse, we would have spoken up," because a couple of former wrestlers have accused Jordan of turning a blind eye. So this story continues.
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Good morning, Dan and Amy. Well, with the nomination of Judge Brett Kavanaugh, the pro-abort left is in full lather. You had the P-Hat Posse, the Women's March organizers, yesterday, in their customary thoughtful fashion, issue a cut-and-paste press release before the nominee was announced that had an X marks the spot to just insert the name once it was announced. They don't care.
Well, they had a protest to it, the steps of the Supreme Court, and literally the protesters were seen writing in Kavanaugh's name once they heard the word.
Yeah, it could have been any name.
Right.
Yeah. But so is that going to be enough to energize women in the midterms? Does that present a real problem for Trump and Republicans? There's some new polling evidence that it does, even as, by the way, the two key Republican female senators on the confirmation, Murkowski and Collins, both voted for Alito, by the way.
Right.
Even though Judge Alito said during his confirmation hearing that Roe v. Wade was not settled law.
Okay.
So
they both voted for Gorsuch.
Doug Jones, the Democrat who beat Roy Moore, the current senator from Alabama, he said he's open-minded on the topic. So you could have some red state Democrats crossover as well. I think Kavanaugh is going to present very much like Alito. He is non-threatening. He is politically savvy. He is professional. He is sharp. He understands what this process is.
And
he's going to do well, and he's going to get confirmed.
And he loves his wife.
We met in 2001 when we both worked in the White House. Our first date was on September 10th, 2001. The next morning, I was a few steps behind her as the Secret Service shouted at all of us to sprint out the front gates of the White House because there was an inbound plane. In the difficult weeks that followed, Ashley was a source of strength for President Bush and for everyone in this building. Through bad days and so many better days since then, she has been a great wife and inspiring mom. I thank God every day for my family.
Yeah.
I mean, you had me at hello.
I think, I mean,
literally, I was in tears yesterday.
It was a very Mayberry performance, and I'm not saying it's not authentic. That could very well be who he is. It came across as authentic, but it's also politically savvy, and the two things aren't necessarily mutually exclusive. There is an issue with Republican Party and women. There has been for a long time. The Center for Women in American Politics at Rutgers notes that the gender gap in every presidential election since 1980, there has been one since 1980, the gap in 2016, 11 points, was the largest gap dating back to 1980. But there have been other instances where it was 10 or 11 points. So that was not unusual. And the reason one of the reasons Trump won was because it was not unusual, right? He lost women by a much narrower margin than was anticipated through much of the election cycle. Well, so updating that the polling demographics or the polling on the female demographic, it's pretty interesting because this does provide some instruction going into, you know, we're basically 5 months from Election Day.
Yeah.
The president's approval rating is 54 among men is 54-45 positive. Among women, this is all. Washington Post SCAR school poll. 54-45 among men. Women, 32-65. I mean, that's a 45-point difference between men and women in this country. Trump's approval rating among self-identified Republicans, 91 among men, 82 among women. But the gap in intensity is what's important because intensity, particularly in the midterm, gives you some indication of turnout. 68% of male Republicans say they strongly approve of the way Trump is handling his job, but just 31% of female Republicans say the same. 37-point spread. So 82% of women, Republican women, say approve of what he's doing, obviously an overwhelming majority, but only 31% are enthusiastic about it. That's important when it comes to turnout. On his handling of the economy across the population, 6 in 10 men give him positive marks, fewer than 4 in 10 women do. Among Republicans, there's a 27-point difference between men and women in the, again, the intensity expressed in the way president is dealing with the economy. Same thing on immigration. Most men across the spectrum trust Trump over Democrats to handle immigration, but women feel the opposite. 41-19. By almost 2-1, men trust Trump more than Democrats to deal with border security. Among women, it's almost evenly split. So there is a real substantial disconnect even within self-identified Republican women on the score of intensity and midterms, and frankly, elections more and more so in this polarized atmosphere are base plus exercises. Turn out your base. If you cannot turn out your base, you cannot win. The interesting thing, too, is right now, just in terms of midterms, thinking about this, in 2016, 63% of eligible women, 59% of eligible men voted. That's 10 million more women casting ballots. The pattern in midterms is similar, but the differences have been smaller, about 5 to 6 million more women than men as compared to 10 million in the general. Asked about the importance of voting this fall, 77% of women, 74% of men say it's extremely or very important. But most motivated today, 54% of men say voting this year is extremely important, while women, it's 39. So the most motivated, there's a 15-point spread for men, which probably benefits Republicans at present. So there's a couple of things here. One is Republicans need to do a better job of persuading women, generally speaking. That's a fact. Number two is you have this opportunity for Republicans through base plus strategies and tactics, but also this danger if the Democrats are able to do the same with a base that is not as motivated as they would like it to be, at least the female portion of the base, and can Roe v. Wade be the way to trigger more women to come out, more women to feel like this is important. It seems like Democrats have been looking for that issue to really light their base on fire, and they've tried a couple, and it, you know, the Kavanaugh confirmation fight is going to come and go. Can they keep the fervor over Roe v. Wade up even after Kavanaugh is confirmed? You know, I think that's an open question on an issue that evenly divides the public.
Well, do you think Roe versus Wade is going to be overturned? Do you think same-sex marriage will remain in America? Because people ask me that all the time.
I think it's possible that both could be overturned, especially with respect to an open question as to who is the next justice to retire or pass away, and then who would have that appointment to nominate somebody. So if
Ruth Bader Ginsburg, what, she's 85, granted, she's in
something
better
like
shape than you and I. But that's all right. Well,
no, she's
she
not.
She does her burpees.
I don't fall asleep during the State of the Union address.
That's true. But she, you know, I mean, she's 85. That, enough said. So if she goes, I think he'd replace her with Amy Barrett.
Well,
don't you?
He replaced her with somebody from the list, so you would have another conservative justice, and then you'd really have a working supermajority on the court. Roe v. Wade is bad law. I agree with Megan McArdle, self-identifies as pro-choice. The piece I referenced, she wrote in the Washington Post last week about let Roe go. It's terrible law. There's no constitutional basis for it. It should be overturned. Based on the Constitution, it should be overturned. And then it's left to the states.
Right. And then Illinois would become the abortion capital of the world. They'd have vacation packages where, hey, stay on the Mag Mile, get your abortion, and then go eat at TGI or whatever restaurant you want.
We basically have that now. We don't need Roe v. Wade to be the law of the land to have that now in Illinois, thanks to Governor Rauner and Planned Parenthood. That tandem has brought that to Illinois anyway. But, again, it's worth noting all of these sexual revolution cases or sexual revolution regressions, I would argue, advances, they would argue, have occurred through the courts, not through legislative bodies. They couldn't do it through the legislative process. They had to do it through the courts. When it was referendums to redefine marriage, they lost the first 32 of them, 33 of them. You move back to legislating on these matters. This is the province of the legislative branch, not the judicial branch, making law from the bench, writing op-eds from the bench, masquerading as judicial interpretations the way McCarthy did in the Obergefell decision, the way that Blackmun did in the Roe v. Wade decision. So could those cases be overturned? Yeah, sure. Guess what? Plessy v. Ferguson was overturned by Brown versus Board of Education. Dred Scott was overturned. Bad law should be overturned. So what? And then you, something that is properly in the province of the legislative branch is determined by state legislatures in the 50 laboratories of democracy. What's so hysterical about that? If the law in California or Illinois or New York will be different than the law in Utah or Louisiana or Florida. So what? Whoever has the best model is probably going to attract the most people. That's what's happening now. Why are certain cases, particularly cases that are without constitutional foundation, held sacrosanct, such that people are, you know, hysterical? People are so hysterical. Shannon Bream couldn't do her show outside the steps of the Supreme Court because she didn't feel safe yesterday.
Really?
Did you see that? Very few times I felt threatened while on the field. The mood here tonight is very volatile. Law enforcement appears to be closing down First Street in front of SCOTUS. So she went back into the studio to do her show because she didn't feel safe. I felt threatened while out in the field. The mood here tonight, very volatile, said Shannon Bream, who's, you know, no shrieking violet. So you're going to have the hysterics, but that doesn't necessarily translate into motivating people who don't live and breathe and die. Those people are not a part of the professional protester class out to vote in November. And that's how the balance of power in the legislative branch, and then by extension, what Trump is able to do the last 2 years of his first term from the executive branch and including judicial appointments, that's how that will be determined. So it's very important. The question is, who's motivated and by what? Mark in Des Plaines, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Hi, you guys. Really good stuff you're talking about, Dan. And Amy, your question, you know, is my question. How is this guy going to vote? That's my question. Kennedy was a disappointment, on, you know, because he kept flip-flopping between both sides. And I just don't want, you know, this guy to be like that. I want him to be strong on things like, you know, Obamacare and like certainly abortion. But, you know, these things are these and absolutely gay marriage. It's ridiculous that we have that we're not centered on the family, you know, in the way law, and mostly important, centered on the Constitution itself. That's Constitution the way it's written. Don't write law.
Thanks for the call, Mark. Sean in Elmwood Park.
You know, as I'm watching this process, Prof, one thing I see is that it's steady as it goes. I have never seen such a process where Republicans are guaranteeing socialists, don't worry, everything's going to be fine. I mean, I like the guy. He sounds like a wonderful guy when he was talking about, doesn't he? He sounds like a great guy. But what this shows you is I don't care anymore. After Roberts rewrote the law, you know how a fat judge in a little robe, Kagan's going to vote on every issue, not to mention Sotomayor. You've got just the socialists against the pretend not to be socialists. I'll tell you the truth. I've lost absolute faith. And to me, the Supreme Court, they're a spittoon to me. I don't care what they decide about anything.
That makes no sense. And it's also
why
just.
Why does it make sense? I've decided to reject society.
Well, okay, fine. Well, now
Sean doesn't like anything.
Sean's rejecting society after society's rejected him. I'm just saying that the Supreme.
Pull out on North Avenue just now. Pull out on North Avenue. Here's a scumbag smoking a joint. Is she covered in my insurance pool? Are they going to make sure we're all covered? And as far as these justices, you got a conservative. What did he vote for? He's going to uphold Obamacare, and don't worry, you can kill your baby without repercussion.
Thanks for the call, Sean. That's not Kavanaugh's position in either case, but I appreciate that you're just kind of cursing the darkness. So we've got a lot of cases that that Judge Kavanaugh has weighed in on, both for the majority opinions as well as in dissents. And when it comes to Second Amendment rights, when it comes to immigration policy, when it comes to the administrative state, we were discussing this with Georgetown Law Professor Randy Barnett at the top of the 7 o'clock hour. We'll discuss it with John Malcolm at the bottom of this hour. You have somebody who is, as Barnett described, committed to the separation of powers. That's a good thing. Committed to judicial restraint. That's a good thing. There's a hefty amount of cases that suggest he is committed to an originalist judicial philosophy. He invoked that during his introduction yesterday after the president introduced him as his nominee. So, I mean, you can just say that everybody's the same in spite of all the evidence if you want and just decry everything equally if you want. But I don't know what purpose that serves. Number one, the Supreme Court is not going away. The Supreme Court is going to be impactful on the law of the land in America. The laws under which we live and the social mores those laws reflect. So it seems to me this is something where you'd want to get engaged and get engaged in a thoughtful way, not like the P-hat posse on the one side or Sean from Elmwood Park on the other.
You're listening to Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560. The Answer.
Dan Proft, you're not following me on Twitter, and I've lost Twitter followers because of you. So you'll maybe get a chance to explain yourself.
I want to know who you've lost because of me. I want
Karen Lewis.
I want their Twitter. Oh, yeah, she's blocked me.
Well, I lost her, and then she blocked me. It's a double whammy.
The things that you do, what you must sacrifice to me by broadcast partner, it's nothing short of heroic, really.
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer.
Hey, Joe Walsh here. The pick is in. What does it mean? We'll talk about that when Freedom returns at 5.
Dan and Amy, the accusations about how I've cost you Twitter followers. Let me just say that, number one, those aren't followers you wanted if they've unfollowed you because of me.
Or blocked me. But you're not even following. Okay, sorry.
Well, I mean, number two, Desmond Clark.
Yes.
Professional athlete.
Former Chicago Bear, who you got to golf with
Bears,
at our tournament.
Bears tight end, great. Yeah, played 12 years in the show. Mm-hmm. I've gained 2,000 followers by Dan Proft following me. Just two world-class athletes connecting. That's right. The Good Hands team, two world-class athletes, me and Desmond Clark. Uh-huh. And, you know, the two of us together, the sum.
Yes.
Or the whole, I should say, greater than the sum of the two parts. and the four hands. Okay. All right.
Are you following me on Twitter yet?
I don't know if I...
Will you get to it later today, please?
Yeah, I'll work on that.
I can't believe it.
I'll work on
that. After all these years? It's so rude. I thought we were friends.
I never followed Bruce Wolf either, and he was very upset about that. Because I can only take so much tedium in 4 hours.
I don't think we spent enough time together.
All right. So now we turn our sights to the nominee for the Supreme Court, Brett Kavanaugh. By the way, over the weekend, the holiday weekend, Michelle Wolf, this ghastly comedian who did the White House Correspondents' Dinner, and then she, you know, kind of made fun of Sarah Sanders.
Oh, she bombed. She was embarrassing. Yeah.
I've never really seen her before, but she's got a show on Netflix.
Yeah.
And here's what she did. By the way, what you're about to hear is only about 15 degrees less than the shrillness you will hear from Democrat senators during the confirmation hearings for Brett Kavanaugh. Listen to Michelle Wolf celebrating Independence Day with a salute to abortion.
So tonight, in honor of America, I'd like to do a salute to abortion in the Break's 10th annual Salute to Abortion.
Dressed like Uncle
supposed
Sam.
Supposed to be funny? Yeah. Does she have pictures of fetuses?
Abortion, I salute you! Women, if you need an abortion, get one! If you want an abortion, get one! If you're not pregnant but you think you eventually might be and want to order a future abortion, get one! If you're pregnant and you want to be pregnant, don't get one! Actually a great deal. It's about $300. That's like six movie tickets. Movie tickets, a bad deal. And women, don't forget, you have the power to give life, and men will try to control that. Don't let them. God bless abortions, and God bless America.
Yeah, that's where the left is. That's where the pee hats are. That's what you're going to hear from the protesters in the streets that are organizing at present to protest Brett Kavanaugh as the next Supreme Court justice. That's what you're going to hear. I mean, seriously, you're going to hear a version of that in muted terms from DiFi and others, because you've heard it already from them. Dick Durbin and the like. So as well as Brett Kavanaugh presented yesterday, and as robust and as much as robust as his record is, as much intellectual heft as he brings to the table, don't think that this is going to be anything other than this awful screeching that you hear on shows like Michelle Wolf's and, you know, every show on MSNBC. For more on this topic, we're pleased to be joined by John Malcolm. He's the vice president of the Heritage Foundation, the Institute for Constitutional Government, director of the Mies Center for Legal and Judicial Studies, and a senior legal fellow. John Malcolm was in the audience yesterday, as was the namesake for the Legal and Judicial Studies program there, Ed Mies. It was great to see Ed Mies up and around and able to attend. John Malcolm, thanks so much for joining us. Appreciate it.
Yeah, I'm left a bit speechless by that lead-in, but I'm delighted to be with you.
Yeah, well, these are somewhat speechless times. You've got to refuse fascism organizing protests around the country against a guy they just heard of yesterday at 8 o'clock Central Time. So strange times we're living in. But give us your perspective on Kavanaugh, because you wrote about this a couple of years ago at the Daily Signal, one of the Heritage Foundation publications, about the next Supreme Court justice, and featured Kavanaugh prominently for consideration by President Trump.
Yeah, so about a month after Justice Scalia died, I wrote this article for the Daily Signal saying, look, whoever the next president is, here is a non-exclusive list of eight people who I think would be superb Supreme Court justices. Seven of the names of my eight made it onto the president's list, and he was kind enough to credit Heritage Foundation, along with other groups like the Federalist Society, for informing his thinking. And Brett Kavanaugh was on my list. I think the world of Brett Kavanaugh. He has a very distinguished record, Yale Law School, clerk for Anthony Kennedy, served under Ken Starr in the Office of Independent Counsel, partner in a prestigious Washington firm, 5 years a senior advisor to President George W. Bush in the White House, and for the last dozen years, he has been a stellar judge on the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals, which is usually considered the second most powerful court in the land. He's issued over 300 opinions on a variety of areas. He's an incisive thinker and an excellent writer, very reasoned, and has an approach to judging that I admire. He's an originalist. He's a textualist. He believes in separation of powers. He is skeptical of what's referred to as Chevron deference, which is the extreme deference that courts give to executive branch agencies when they're interpreting arguably ambiguous laws. I think he's a full package, and it's going to be a very contentious confirmation hearing, as you could just tell. But I think at the end of the day, he will get confirmed, and the country will be better off for it.
And don't you think he did a good job of introducing himself to the American people and basically selling himself? I mean, he just said the truth. He's philanthropic. He delivers meals to homeless people through Catholic Charities. He's involved in his kids' basketball coaching. Do you think he scored points with the people last night?
Yeah, look, so, I do know Brett Kavanaugh a little bit. He's got a lovely family. He's a very friendly, humble guy, and I think the American people got a glimpse of that last night, and they're going to see more of that in the days ahead. He's going to be virulently attacked during his confirmation hearings, as Neil Gorsuch was, but I think he will. He's used to that kind of heat, particularly from his 5 years in the Bush White House, and I think he'll hold up beautifully.
And with respect to the selection of Kavanaugh over some other highly decorated, qualified contenders, a lot is made of that he's got a substantial record, so he's a bit of a more of a known quantity than maybe some of the other choices. The other thing, it seems to me, though, picking on what Amy was talking about, his introduction to the American public last night, political savvy. He's been around. He's been inside the Beltway. He understands the process, and he'll do a pretty good job being his own navigator through it.
Yeah, no, I think that's right. I mean, he is highly regarded by judges from all around the country of all political stripes. Akhil Amar, who's a very liberal and well-known law professor at Yale, has an article, I haven't seen it yet, but I've heard about it, in the New York Times today that says, look, politically, I couldn't be more different than Brett Kavanaugh, but he's clearly qualified and will do an outstanding job on the Supreme Court. So, yeah, he's a very savvy individual, but he's also a very humble and friendly individual, and that's going to come through.
Now, there's a couple of cases, though, looking at his history, his professional record, that conservatives have taken issue with, and they were batted around before he was leveled up as the choice from President Trump. And we did that earlier in the show with Randy Barnett from Georgetown Law. One is an Obamacare-related case, and Barnett takes the position that some who have been critical of Kavanaugh in that case specifically, boy, that he really did provide essentially the roadmap for Roberts to hold that Obamacare and the individual mandate was unconstitutional, and that was not Kavanaugh's finest moment, and it's a concerning one.
Yeah, look, I have hold Randy Barnett, whom I consider a friend in the highest regard. I just disagree with him on that. So there were two issues in the Obamacare case. One is when the court should consider the case, and there is something called the Anti-Injunction Act. And then there was the question about whether or not you could uphold the individual mandate under Congress's taxing power in the Constitution. It is the latter ruling that Chief Justice Roberts used, and he was the only one to rule that way. He had to be coupled with the four liberals who would have upheld Congress's power under the Commerce Clause. But Brett Kavanaugh wasn't talking about the taxing power to uphold the constitutionality of the individual mandate. He was dealing with the former issue about whether the label attacks meant that the Anti-Injunction Act applied and that the case was premature. And I think that was whether it was a right decision or wrong decision, it was an eminently defensible decision. It's completely different from the reasoning that Chief Justice Roberts used. And in fact, he was in dissent against a majority opinion of the D.C. Circuit that went ahead and said that we should consider the case and that the individual mandate is in fact constitutional. So, he's got to deal with the reality of he was on a court with a majority of liberal judges. And I think his decision, you can disagree with it, but I do not think it was nearly as categorical cataclysmic as some conservatives did. I knew about that decision at the time that I made my recommendation in 2016, and so it obviously didn't deter me, and I still think he'll be an outstanding Supreme Court justice.
Yeah, and there, of course, there's going to be some political pushback. Senator Schumer slowed his nomination to the D.C. Appeals Court for 3 years. Do you think he's going to try and drag this along, too? I mean, he doesn't really have the power to do so, but he's going to try.
Yeah, oh, absolutely. Look, the Democrats are throwing as much mud on the wall as they can, hoping that something sticks. You are right. He was nominated originally to the D.C. Circuit in 2003. He wasn't confirmed until 2006, and he attracted a lot of negative attention from Chuck Schumer and others because of his work in the Bush White House and, to some extent, work he did for independent counsel Ken Starr during the Monica Lewinsky investigation. But he got confirmed then, and he will be confirmed now. It's going to be tough. It's going to be ugly. But I think at the end of the day, you know, he will be confirmed. And as I say, the American people will be better off for it.
There was another concern expressed by some with respect to Kavanaugh. And the American Family Association actually has come out against his nomination, which is rather surprising. But the Priest for Life case, Priest for Life versus HHS, the Obamacare contraception mandate. And the,
right.
the suggestion there was that his dissent was not strong enough in defense of religious liberty. How do you respond to that?
Yeah, so he's caught some flack from the right for the Priest for Life case and also for an abortion decision involving an illegal immigrant teenager who mm-hmm. insisted on abortion on demand. In both of those cases, he dissented from majority opinions and ruled with the administration. In the Priest for Life case, all he said was, look, even if the government can make an argument that providing contraceptive services to religious nonprofit employees, even if they can establish that this is a compelling government interest, didn't concede that it was, but even if they can, there are less restrictive alternatives. So he ruled in favor of the administration, just as he did in the illegal immigrant abortion case. The fact that he didn't go with the most pure decision, I think, is again defensible. Judge Kavanaugh is a very strategic judge. He is on a court with the majority of Democrats. If he's not going to persuade his fellow judges on the D.C. Circuit, he then has to present arguments that will appeal to the Supreme Court so that they will take the case
right.
and ultimately rule his way. It's a strategy he's employed over the years very successfully, and I don't fault him for doing it in those cases either.
For those concerned that he could turn out to be another Judge Roberts with respect to the Obamacare case or
right.
Anthony Kennedy with respect to, frankly, religious liberty and moral issues generally, how do you respond? Is this somebody who's going to be more like Alito or Scalia, or is there the possibility that we could be in the Roberts-Kennedy area?
Well, you know, look, time will tell, but I don't see that as a concern. I mean, Brett Kavanaugh in speeches, writings, opinions has made it clear that he is a textualist. He is an originalist. Neither Roberts nor Kennedy could ever be accused of being either of those. And I think he has a stiff backbone. I mean, you know, I think Neil Gorsuch was a home run because he's an originalist and a textualist, and I think that Brett Kavanaugh will be the same.
All right. He is John Malcolm, VP at the Heritage Foundation, the Institute for Constitutional Government, director of the Mies Center for Legal and Judicial Studies, and a senior legal fellow there who was at the introduction of Brett Kavanaugh to the nation yesterday. John Malcolm, thanks so much for joining us. Appreciate it.
Great to be with you.
And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
This is the morning show. More Chicago radio listeners are choosing. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560. The Answer.
Thanks for listening to Chicago's Morning Answer podcast, sponsored by Signature Bank. Signature Bank takes pride in helping customers grow their business and provide unmatched banking expertise, custom financial solutions, and the industry's best technology. So whether you're a business looking for a deposit relationship or needs a ready source of financing, Signature Bank is the right bank for you. Call today at 773-467-5600 to hear how Signature Bank can help your business grow and thrive. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.